You're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And on this episode, we are discussing the play Burning Vision by Marie Clements. This is a play that I recently read, like a few months ago, I read it for the first time, and then I liked it so much that I added it to my syllabus for my theater and society class. And I put it at the end of the semester because it's a very complex play, which I'm sure Sarah will talk about. But just to give kind of an overview of the play for people who haven't read it, Marie Clements is looking at different communities that are linked by the heavy air quotes discovery of uranium. Mm-hmm. And the people, the Dene people on whose land this uranium was mined, and then the people of Japan where the atomic bomb was dropped, and looking at the kind of link between these two communities on opposite sides of the world, and how they're linked, how they share this link of uranium. And it's a very kind of nonlinear play that moves back and forth in time and space. Lots of characters, lots of kind of poetic vignettes that like bleed into each other. And yeah. So, Sarah, what were your first impressions of this play?
My first impressions was to not read this play 1 a.m. trying to take care of a 4-month-old.
Yeah. That could be said for many plays, I think.
I think so, but particularly this play. Now, so this play, I think, like, I was really drawn to this idea, the uranium, the discovery of it, or like the how these different characters' relationships was centered around this. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, I was like, would you consider this a docudrama?
Ooh, good question.
Because even though I feel like it's very experiential, you know, it's very mm-hmm. It's not your typical like linear traditional play or anything. It's very it's very exploratory. Mm-hmm. But I was like, because the source material is based on, you know, something that's actually true and happened, and that like, could this be is this a docudrama play?
I feel like I would say it's not a docudrama, although it mm-hmm. does have a lot of historical elements because, well, a lot of the characters are fictional people, mm-hmm. even if they're based on, you know, people who would really have been living during this time, these times. Mm-hmm. And it seems less interested in telling like a series of events exactly as they happen factually, and more interested in the kind of layering of how these different communities were connected. Yeah, affected by the discovery of uranium and the mining of it and the atom bomb and how they were connected to each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know if I would call it a docudrama.
Hmm. That's interesting. I wonder who out there would disagree.
Please, I welcome disagreement.
Another thing that struck me was the characters, like all the, you know, it's a long list of characters.
A lot of characters, yeah. And I think many of them are double cast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was one other thing that struck me as and the structure of the play was broken down to 4 movements. We could get into a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was interesting, too, just the way, I guess, how it was organized.
Yeah. Doesn't feel like a conventional, you know, three-act structure.
Yeah.
Aristotelian, you know, rising action, climax,
mm-mm,
falling action. It feels very, like you were talking about music, how the structure of all these movements make you think of music.
Yeah.
And I agree. And it also feels kind of like a dance piece or a movement, you know, like a physical movement piece.
Yeah.
I would love to see it because I feel like just reading it on the page, I don't really get a sense of what it could be in three dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I said movements, the only time I've seen movement, right, is like in music and music, mm-hmm, sheets. And like I've seen in, you know, movement 45, you don't know, like you just, mm-hmm, that's the only time I have that frame of reference is through music. And so every time I see a play that says, oh, movement one, you know, and then my brain is just sort of like, okay, it's not act one, it's movement one. And I start reframing my mind into like, this is going to, not, it's gonna be a music, like it feels like it's a music is like abstract to me, like it's not,
yeah,
and so it's not gonna you know, have beginning, middle, end. Well, maybe there is, but like not in the traditional sense of a story, you know. So immediately when I got jumped into it, when I see the title, like, oh, movement one, here what's happening, like, oh, let me see I can pull it up. What was the title, first one? It says, oh, the frequency of discovery, movement one. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I don't want to read this like first description here. It says, intense darkness is pierced by light that reveals foreboding scenes of human suffering, pain, grief, loss, and isolation. Like, those are abstract ideas.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's not like, oh, here's a setting. Here's the chairs here. Here's a table. And we're, you know, really setting the scene. But it says, foreboding scenes of human suffering, pain, grief, loss, and isolation. Which is so open to interpretation, like what that could look like, you know. I was thinking, if I was a designer, I was like, oh, maybe it's going to be visual and maybe there's a video screen and literally montages of what's going on.
Right, yeah. I think you could totally do it that way. Yeah. And part of what I love about that kind of stage direction is every production of it could look so different depending, mm-hmm, on how the director and designers interpret that stage direction. Yeah.
Yeah, so in that sense, like, I feel like it's very designer, like, friendly, kind of like they could bring in their expertise and they could really collaborate here.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm like, my brain's like, what does this mean?
Like, yeah. What does it look like? Yeah.
What does it look like? I don't know. Maybe I just want to be told what to think.
Well, no, I completely agree. And there are some moments in the play where she does choose to be really specific. Like, mm-hmm, I'm thinking about this moment where we meet the Japanese grandmother and we get this stage direction that – and this to me feels more like a dance piece even. I'll just read this direction. From far away, an old Japanese woman dressed traditionally in a red kimono carries a heavy burden on her back. She marches in slow motion – steadily, beautifully, toward a cherry branch outstretched. Koji points to the dream coming through the light tunnel. He holds the fish tightly as he begins to realize he is watching himself as a child being carried by his grandmother. And then there's this song. And it's like that, just that moment could take like 30 seconds or 10 minutes. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, depending on how you stage it. She has so much specificity in the colors and like what the characters are doing and how they're moving, but, mm-hmm, she still leaves it really open in terms of duration and, you know, just like how that moment lands, I think.
Yeah.
In a way, it feels, a lot of this play to me feels like poetry, where it's making these connections, yep, between images and kind of, what am I trying to say? Showing these allusions and metaphors rather than kind of concrete. This happened and then this happened and then this happened.
Mm. Sorry, I'm so distracted by my baby.
I can hear him.
You can hear? Augie. He's learned, he's like learning how to speak. So he's just like being vocal about everything. He just like he's like not babbling. Like he babbles, but he's like shrieking.
What is he saying? Are you able to decipher? No,
but like this
or is
it shrieking.
Just noises?
No, this one specifically, like, I'm pretty sure, like, Nick is making him laugh. So aww. Instead of, like, your usual, like, ha-ha-ha laughter, he's like, ah! Oh, my yeah. God. It's really funny. But, man, it's just so funny. I'm just like, I can't even be serious about this play because he's, like, in the background screaming. Oh, man. He's so wow. funny. Anyways, we digress. Back to this play. Were there characters that really stood out to you?
Yeah, so I really love the dynamic between there are these two characters named Little Boy and Fat Man, which are named after these American, I think the planes that carried the bombs. But in this play, they're actually, well, you find out at the end of the play that they're in this like kind of bomb test site and that Fat Man is a dummy. And then Little Boy is, so she describes him as the personification of uranium. So when you first meet him, and he's embodied as this native boy who's like 8 years old. And so when you first meet him, he's one of the first characters you hear from. He has this line, "Every child is scared of the dark, not because it is dark, but because they know sooner or later they will be discovered." And so you meet him as this like embodiment of uranium under the earth, waiting thousands of years alone. And then you know, these miners come, but you also see him in this test site house, this like fake house with Fat Man, who's just this like American guy sitting on a couch, drinking beer, watching TV. And I don't know, I just love like the texture and the specificity of the scenes between these two. Mm-hmm. Even though, I mean, I don't find Fat Man a particularly likable character. He's like kind of gross yeah. and unfriendly, like kind of hostile to Little Boy. Although one of my students did write that he was like, "I want to be like Fat Man and just watch TV and drink beer." So I was like, "That's great, good for you."
We all want that.
But I don't know. I think maybe one of the reasons I love these scenes so much is that there's such a difference in tone and color and texture to the rest of the play, which feels very dreamlike. Mm-hmm. And I think it's almost like having a meal where you have lots of different flavors and you want something like salty and acidic to balance out the more heavy stuff, or mm-hmm. you want like a difference, like a variety of tastes. And so something about having these characters and these scenes balance out the other flavors in the play really is very satisfying to me.
I was really drawn to how this play travels through time. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but it's like I find myself, I'm here in the U.S. jumping to Japan. Like, I'm like, how did this happen? Like, but it's like, it's such a interesting way of like, it's like the playwright is able to expand and contract the locations and also time, because it's also I think my copy there was like a timeline. I'm like, the discovery of the uranium and how it's like these moments, how it influenced, there's like a specific events, historical events that happened. Mm-hmm. I also liked in the last one, it was April 26, 2002, Burning Vision opening night was included in this timeline.
In the timeline, yeah.
Which is so funny because I'm like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah. And it start, I think the earliest scene is in 1880.
1880s, yeah.
So it's like, the prophecy. The span of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And it says here, the prophecy by Dean. Denny Medicine Man?
Denae. Mm-hmm.
Denae Medicine Man. And then, and so, yeah, just like the span of time. So I got that feeling. Like in this play, like I had this feeling I'm traveling through time, whether it was through, you know, one line to the next or to the description, to the stage directions. Like it felt very cinematic and expansive that way.
Yeah And she finds ways to connect them that are rooted in like the characters' journeys more mm-hmm. than rooted in what would be, you know, physically possible if you followed the laws of time and space.
Yeah.
So like I'm thinking about the moment where Koji, who's in Japan, is hanging from this cherry branch and then he lets go and like falls through the sky. And then the next time you see him, he's splashed down into the ocean in another part of the world. Mm-hmm. Where these people are in a boat. And like these ways that she finds to have people talk to each other across time and space are so cool, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking that, let's say you were to take these historical events and really literally, and you're like, okay, act one, scene one, we're going to start here. And then you just sort of like move through
chronologically, yeah.
Traditionally. And then it could be boring, could be not, I don't know. But there's something what she's doing to something differently where I'm throwing that out the window, but there's still a sense of the events, like the history is here, but mm-hmm. like there's just so much, I don't know, a lot of play. And then that, I think that one makes it feels like theatrical because mm-hmm. the way you just describe are like from jumping from one space to the next, like that's what makes this, like I could only see this in the theater. I don't want to like see this.
Yeah.
On a TV show or like in a movie. Like this just feels...
It wouldn't work.
Yeah.
I know. And it feels like, to your point about, you know, she could have made it chronological, but it's so not that. It makes it feel like time is circular or like things repeat or like everything throughout time is happening all at the same time in a way, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, yeah, I can't think of another play I've read or seen that works with time in this way.
Yeah. I guess then I'm thinking now, what do you think is the playwright's intention of like, why write this way to share the story?
Well, when I was doing some research, I found that she was kind of, I think she was inspired to write this play because of learning about the connection between this community where the uranium was found and then how they actually formally apologized to the people of Japan mm-hmm. for, even though the Dene people are not the one who created the bomb or dropped it, but that they felt this obligation to apologize for the violence that came out of the uranium that was found like under their land. And she was just really interested in this relationship between these two groups of people on other sides of the world and how they were linked across time and space. And I think, I mean, I don't want to speak for her, but I think what I'm getting from the play is this way in which times can really speak to each other and that, you know, healing or atonement for violence that's been done and harms that have been done can go both like backwards and forwards in time. But yeah, I don't know. I just think there's something about the way she's working with this prophecy in 1880 about, you know, what would happen with the bomb, even though the seer doesn't specifically name like the atom bomb, he has this prophecy about what's going to happen and the death and destruction that will be caused, and the way you see these moments that are decades apart happen like right next to each other or right on top of each other.
Yeah.
Feels kind of, I don't know, it feels kind of healing in a way. Like you can, when you see these characters, and then there's also all these other characters who have been poisoned by working with this toxic stuff. Like, so you have the radium painter from the 1930s, and she's like slowly poisoned by working with radium. And then you have the Dene ore carrier who I think develops cancer from carrying this toxic stuff. And like, I don't know, somehow seeing the way that all these different people are linked feels kind of, and that they're able to talk to each other across the time feels kind of healing.
Yeah. I was early this week, I read the musical Strange Loop. I was able to get the book, and I was reading it and while listening to on Spotify the soundtrack. And I was like, as I was reading, I was like, and then when I went to the song, I was like, listen, I would press play and listen to the soundtrack.
Wow.
It was a commitment, all right? And this play kind of reminded me of that play for some reason. And I guess the way I was like reading and listening to it was this, there was no sense of like a singular location. It was constantly like moving, because and Strange Loop is about this main character, and like it's like a character, it's a the main character is a writer too, and like and then it's like how he's kind of living through life, and just like his family, the things that his relationship with his family and the world, and just like as a writer and like as a queer person, you know, all that. There's no singular location, but one minute we're in the subway, one minute we're in his room, one minute he's in the lover's room. I don't know. Like, we're just like, it didn't feel like there was a set, but there was a feeling of like we're moving location because based on this character's memory, like we're moving through time this way. And so there was a sense of that where I kind of got this feeling with this play was that it really was like living up to my imagination of like how I really was moving through the story that this way was through that time and the change in the location. And I was just making me think, like, I feel like I need to read plays like this once in a while because, like, I don't – it's – there's this – I don't know how to say these words. But, like, there's this thing of where I feel like it's – mom brain. Breaking up, like, this sense of – form, like I'm like so used to writing or thinking how a play should look and then like structurally and like beginning, middle, end, like I'm always like thinking this way, and I feel like every play I've written I'm always working in this frame. But when I replay like Burning Vision or Strange Loop, I'm like, why do I always kind of feel like I need to be confined in this, you know, like why can't I break out of this? and like, who taught me this Aristotelian way of thinking?
Right.
But, you know, I'm just like, why do I always find myself thinking that I need, this is the groundwork. I need to stay here in this groundwork and never like jump off of it.
Right. Well, and it really goes back to what you're saying about how it wouldn't, you couldn't do this as a film. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't mm-hmm. really work. And I think it's very refreshing to read something by a playwright who's like so dedicated to exploring what's possible on stage.
Yeah.
And not, I think, you know, there are a lot of playwrights who are writing today who also want to write for screen, which is great. But it, that I think that that sometimes does something to the plays that they're writing also.
Yeah.
Because the, and I know nothing about writing for TV and film. You know way more than I do. But it's so much more structured than than playwriting has to be.
Yeah.
I was thinking too about, to go back to your question about like why, what do you think her intention was with writing in this way? And I was thinking about how I think one of the things this play says is that if you harm a community across, like on the other side of the world, that harm is going to come back to you in a way. Like there's, Augie. But there's something about like the way she's connecting people in such different times and spaces and showing how their stories mm-hmm. all are intertwined that really drives home the point that doing violence anywhere like has ripple effects everywhere. And that this destruction caused by the bomb and even just like unearthing this uranium and working with the radium and the, and these toxic poisonous things has these ripple effects for everybody who's involved.
Oof. Wow. Yeah. Now that you say that, I'm like, yep. No, I definitely got that. Yeah. I just got goosebumps.
Oh, thanks. Oof.
Wow. Is this why you're a teacher? Like,
my students were like, it was confusing.
Yeah.
I think it's a play that really should be seen. So I want more people to produce it so then I can go see it somewhere.
Yeah. That was juicy. That was a wow way to end that beat. So juicy. Okay, so I guess if this was what do we say? Oh, a dessert.
Oh yeah, dessert. This play was a dessert. But I want to do a smell.
Oh, a smell. Okay.
Well, I just feel like it smells like it. It feels very elemental to me. So it kind of smells like the ocean and also like digging in the earth.
Dirt. The earth. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Dirt. Yeah. Dirt and seawater. That's two smells. Ooh. But you could do a dessert if you want.
Let's see. I'll let me think of a smell of a dessert then. Yeah, you know, it's a little interesting. I think, yeah, I was thinking if it was a maybe some sort of like, I don't want to say banana bread, but I don't want to think, that's not like a sourdough bread, but it's a type of like
there is a bread. Lot of bread in the play. Yeah, they talk about making bread.
Bread.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like a bread.
Sweet bread.
I'm thinking Japanese milk bread.
Ooh.
Like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Milk bread. It's all sweet, but it's like not too sweet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe that's what it was. So yeah, that's my take. That's my hot take.
That's great. Well, listeners, read it and tell us what you think this play would smell like or taste like.
And Murray Clements, if you're listening to this, just like come on board and talk to us.
Yeah.
talk to us about Burning Vision. I also love the title Burning Vision.
I know, me too.
I really like the title. Okay. Let's move on to Glisten.
Okay.
And I'll go first.
Okay, you go first.
So earlier this week, I went to an in-person, first in-person since March 2020, open mic.
Whoa.
And I had a notebook of like, okay, these are like, you know, jokes I want to say and I'm going to like.
Because you were performing in this
open mic. Yeah, because I'm performing. Yeah. So it was an open mic. So I was like, I went to go and perform and I was like, but as soon as I got on stage, I was just like, I just felt moved by what was going on in the room. And then, because it was like an all women's open mic. So I just felt like I was in a safe place for some reason, you know? Mm-hmm. So I shared my like labor story of Augie. And I was just like, literally just speaking from the heart. Like, I was just like, here's what's happening. Here's like everything that happened leading up to it. Like, you know, I talked about our car getting stolen, you know, and then and then going to delivery and then all the stress of the car. And then I was pushing for 4 hours. Like, it was like a marathon. I'm like, it was just like insane. Like, I just felt like, I think the way I told this, it felt like I'm going to talk about how, it was all difficult. It was really hard. And then, like, as soon as I held Augie, like, August in my arms and like looked at him, I think they were waiting for like, what's gonna be the first thing that comes out of your mouth? What are your first thoughts? And the first thing I said was like, my first thought I literally had after I had Augie was, wow, my vagina is so strong. I was like wow, like I didn't know that my vagina was capable of doing this. But that's literally my first thought. I was like, after all this, like, it's just like a horrible thing and going through all of this. And I'm like, I'm stressed out of my mind. The labor is so hard, pushing is so hard. Like it was just, everything was so challenging.
Your body is amazing.
But my body, I was like, whoa, my vagina is a superhero and it needs its own TV show.
Well, and this is like the price we have paid as a species for our big brains. Uh-huh. Did you know that it's like no other creature has this much trouble giving birth? But it's like as we started growing bigger and bigger brains, the female body had to make all these adaptations just to like give birth to these humongous newborns.
Yeah. But yeah, and what was going on? Oh, wow. Yeah, and this open mic though too. I don't know. I feel like I've done so many open mics, not so many, but like enough where I was like, whenever I go to an open mic, I feel like I have an idea, like, oh, this is what funny is, or like this is what I have to do and sound like. This is like I'm gonna try to be like more like this comedian and maybe like this comedian or stuff like that. But I literally just kind of, this was my first time where I felt like, oh, this is the closest to being me on stage I've ever done.
Aww.
That makes sense. Like,
yeah, just be yourself, Sarah.
Just being myself. But it's very hard because you're still putting on a persona on. But I felt like, oh, this is the closest to like the persona of me that I've been trying to be for a really long time. And I feel like, I don't know. I guess it happens. This is, I guess when you push out a baby out of you, it was like, oh, it's like a wake up. You're like, oh, I did it.
Yeah. I've got nothing to prove anymore.
Yeah, I have nothing else to prove, and this is it. Literally, this is all of me, baby. And yeah. Yeah, so it was really fun.
Are you going to go back?
Oh, yeah. I want to go back. It was just, yeah. It was, like, so fun, and parking was amazing. this is just the thing. Like, going to open mic is such a hell here, and, like, this was great location. It's close to home, 10-minute drive from home, and a lot of ample parking. I was like, I'm coming to this open mic.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, that's it. That's my glisten.
It's great. My glisten is I just saw this documentary called River, which is about rivers of the world. And I didn't even realize while I was watching it, I was really enjoying it, and then got to the end, got to the final credits, and realized that it had been written by this writer who I really admire, who's written all these like kind of like naturalist books for both kids and adults. Wow, I'm blanking on his name. Like, first, this is so embarrassing.
That's what the show's really about, fast. Though. It's all, it's about
the, being well. It's about people. It's about like the relationships between people and rivers, and it shows you all this incredible footage, like throughout the world, of how people have been able to survive because of rivers, and how, like, every, I think they say in the film, like, every major city around the world has a river running through it. Just that, like, you know,
really?
We have survived because of rivers, and then they start, showing dams and how we've, you know, modified and dammed so many rivers. They actually say,
yeah,
there's so much water behind dams that we've actually slowed the rotation of the earth.
What? Like, no,
isn't that
way
crazy? Yeah, just like the immense, what? Immense amount of water that has been dammed. Anyway,
wait, how?
Oh,
how
the writer is Robert McFarlane. Because if you think about, like, you know, without a dam, mm-hmm, water falls from the sky. It hits a mountain or wherever, a field, and then rushes to a river, and then that runs to the ocean. But if you stop that flow, and if you just think about the sheer scale of huge dams around the world, and you stop that, the momentum, then you're pooling all that water in certain places, and that changes the gravity. That changes, like, the, I guess, the rotation of the earth.
That is crazy to think that.
Yeah. I know.
That, well, like, and the, like, way water works?
I just had a thought. I thought I kind of understood what a dam was. But when you see the scale of it in a film like this, it really, at least for me, it changed my perception of what that really means. So the writer is Robert McFarlane. And I just found his name. And the other amazing thing in this documentary is they show footage of clouds, but it's sped up so fast that you really see how clouds are like rivers in the sky, because they've filmed it and then they speed it up so much. And so you see the shapes of these clouds forming and rippling and rushing across the sky, and it just looks like water. It's really cool. Anyway, I saw it on a big screen, which I highly recommend if you can find a theater that's playing it. I think it came out last year, though, so maybe not. But it's also, yeah, you can also watch it online.
Okay.
Dang. Yeah. It will give you a new appreciation for water, for sure.
Yeah. Man, I've been like, I'm just like always so paranoid about our water.
Like, yeah, I know.
Like microplastics and all that. Like, I'm just,
I,
like,
know.
So, and drought. Every time I, like, if I, so my parents, every time I go to their house, mm-hmm, they don't have any kind of like water filtration system. They only buy water bottles.
Mm, wow.
And so every time I go home, I'm just like, okay, you know, I need water, but like, I don't trust their water because it's like the really old house, and I don't know if they've updated the plumbing or anything. So I'm always, mm-hmm, like, I'm not gonna drink your water. So I have to drink this bottle water. But even the bottle water, I get like all paranoid. I'm like, I'm gonna be drinking microplastic.
Yeah, like, it's everywhere. I mean, the really sad thing is, like, there's basically nothing you can consume that doesn't have microplastics in it.
Like food too, right?
Yeah, it's in food. It even just like rains down on us from the sky.
That's so.
I know, it's really sad. It's in everything. Yeah.
So do you think, like, in our system right now, in our stomach, we have microplastic?
Yeah, we have it in our blood.
Oh,
We have it in our tissues. Yeah. Oh
my God. Do you think this is why we have, there's so much like diseases and cancer and like.
I do. I think that's a big part of it. And you can kind of make yourself crazy trying to like purify your life so that you're reducing your intake. But at a certain point that just, I mean, okay, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute, but I think there's a way in which like people who are environmentally minded or health and wellness minded can become so focused on their individual lifestyle that it becomes way more about like the neoliberal consumerist model than it does about like, you know, organizing and changing regulations so that we can protect everybody.
Yeah. And the thing about like the wellness, like all that, it's really like wealthy people that could afford to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, okay, if you put all this energy into protecting yourself and your family,
right,
then what about the rest of the community? Or even like I think about, you know, we can do so much as human beings to protect other human beings with our like filtration. But when the water is poisonous and every other life form is drinking that water, it's really not enough to just say, okay, well, people are protected, in my opinion.
Wow.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go quite there.
I know. But I feel like it's very theme on like what we just talked about and the play we just read. You know, it's this, I mean, you picked this play when you taught in your class.
I know. I know. Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's so funny.
And okay. We reap what we sow.
Oh, my gosh. Sam, I can't wait to just, like, what your PhD program, like, how what are you going to write? And, like, I mean, I freaking love your head. I love your little mind.
Thanks, it's Sarah. Like,
it's just full of information and love it. Okay. All right, that was our episode.
On that note.
On that note, Sam has a great mind. Goodbye.
You have a great mind too, Sarah.
Oh, thank you. It's kind of jacked up right now, but okay. All right, next time, goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.